Welcome to episode 57 of Mancy, a podcast about magic and its influence on our culture. In each set of episodes, we cover a different Mancy or method of magic. I'm RJ Walker. I'm a spoken word poet and writer. With me is my co-host, Elle.
I'm Elle Alder, a professional psychic and solitary eclectic witch.
So, in part one, we went over the history of dice, at least the parts we know of, because it goes well into prehistory. We also discussed the origin of the game craps and its roots in ancient Greek and Roman divination practices. And we talked about the astragali, and we used them, knuckle bones that were precursors to modern-day dice. We rolled them to answer some questions, and we used an ancient translated inscription from an ancient statue of Hermes. Today, we're going to explore cheating, probability, and modern games and modern dice, including and especially Dungeons and Dragons. This is part two of Astragalomancy. Divination with dice. Now, we're going to talk about more modern dice games and the way they might be connected to magic. Anything that involves randomness tends to have some kind of tie to magic. It could give one the appearance of having the gods on their side if random chance sides with you. A powerful negotiating tool. After all, would you go against someone who has divine or supernatural support?
Yes, people often do that.
You fight, gonna fight God, you're in the way.
Yes, that is how people treat me most of the time.
Manipulating probability is one of those superpowers that always seems like really OP. Domino from Marvel Comics has the specific power to manipulate probability, something she calls her luck. She does not do it consciously, rather it simply guides her actions toward the most probable positive outcome. This makes her mostly unstoppable. She's also switching sides frequently as her luck guides her always to the winning side. So she's not really a hero or a villain, more of an anti-hero.
Yeah.
When it comes to rolling dice, there are so many different physics reactions that occur with motion and force that it becomes impossible to predict where the dice will fall. Unless you can control and modify those forces, manipulate the way the dice is thrown, or the dice themselves. In medieval Viking tomb, a certain die was found. It had two fives, two fours, a three, and a six.
Okay.
Dice with missing and duplicated numbers exactly like this, this is called a tops and bottoms die.
Okay.
Tops and bottoms dice. It's a pretty straightforward way to manipulate probability. You just have extra numbers.
I mean, right? if you take some of the numbers away, you're not going to get those.
Of course, that kind of method won't hold up to scrutiny if somebody grabs your die and inspects it. Someone cheating this way must be capable of sleight of hand, switching the dice between rolls to make it seem like they used a legitimate dice. The reason it's called tops and bottoms, if the number showed on top has a duplicate, the dupe is hidden on the bottom. And this specific arrangement makes it seem like there are no duplicates when a duplicate is rolled. It doesn't guarantee a win, but it does increase the probability of certain rolls, which certainly makes it seem like the gods are on your side.
Yeah.
If, 7 times out of 10 you're right.
Right, exactly. Not enough to make them think you're actually cheating.
Yeah.
But more than normal.
Right. Another way to cheat with dice is by using what's called loaded dice.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably heard of this before.
Mm-hmm.
Elle, what's a loaded dice?
I think a loaded dice is a dice that has extra weight in a specific part of the dice that makes it inherently come up one specific number.
That is correct.
Okay.
There's a little more to it.
Okay.
So this is the oldest method, and this was used with astragali as well. It involves controlling the weight and shape of the die cast.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, not all astragali are exactly the same. Imagine getting one out of a sheep that had a bone disease or one that had its bone fractured and refused. The weight would be distributed differently. It would be heavier on one side than the other. This would chaotically alter the distribution on the bone. It's unsurprising that some people had their lucky astragali that they would use for divination and gambling, especially the rich and powerful. When it came to cuboid die, which is what we use when we play games as cubes, people understood that the die would be more likely to land on a side with more weight. Dice found in ancient Egyptian tombs and ancient Chinese tombs as well were modified in this way. With one way to load the dice is to shave off a few sides to make it slightly more of a rectangle.
Okay.
That would make it so that the dice would fall on the sides with greater surface area.
Mm-hmm.
More likely. Even a slight amount could tip the odds just ever so much in your favor. Of course.
Which is all you need.
Yeah. You don't want to do too much because then people would identify it as loaded.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a rich and powerful fucking person, who's going to accuse you of cheating?
Many people do. And then you ignore them because it doesn't matter.
Yeah. And then you open the trap door.
Should we ask Bezos?
Should we ask Bezos?
Yeah.
Are you using loaded die, Jeff Bezos?
I mean, yes. Like,
he's like, no. I am a self-made
Who are you anyway?
Billionaire.
You should really go to the moon the next time you have some money.
Self-made from the hundreds of thousands of dollars my parents gave me to start my business.
Yay! It was about books first.
It was. There was a moment, a slight moment.
A moment.
When it was about books and not about destroying the world.
And here we are.
Yeah.
Books are evil. Maybe we should have banned Jeff Bezos's books and then we would have not been here. I don't know. I'm not sure, but I'm certain he's a cheater. And I'm certain we could ask him and he would have us killed, maybe.
Yeah, probably. Another sneakier way to load the die is, like you said, add weight to one side while constructing it. Either it's set into the die while it's being cast.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're casting out of something like glass.
Resin.
Resin.
Or I guess I wouldn't have resin then.
Stone, cement, anything like that. Then you just put a little weight inside so that it would fall.
Few the, little just, iron
just a
shavings.
Little crumblies at the bottom there at the one, so it lands on six or whatever.
Okay, yeah, you put it where you want to, like on the equal side.
Yeah,
on
you
the
put
opposite
it.
Side.
Yeah, you put it on what you want it to touch on the number you want to touch the table.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the opposite side of the number you want. Where was I? Oh yeah. This can be really difficult to detect.
Yeah.
Because you have to, like, really feel it, and you'd probably need a precision scale. Another way is to drill – make all the other sides lighter. So you drill the holes for the pips just a little deeper on all the sides but one. Is another, like, tricky-dicky way. Or put in pips made of a heavier material inside one side.
Mm-hmm.
Sneaky, sneaky.
Yeah.
The weight change is so impossible. Like, it's so hard to tell the difference between two very small and light things.
Yeah.
Of course, there are ways to defeat these kinds of cheats when it comes to producing dice. Have you ever seen casino dice?
I have.
They're always clear.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Always plastic.
Mm-hmm.
They're made of a very specific plastic, and they always have sharp corners instead of rounded corners.
They do have sharp corners, yes.
Often, the numbers are laser printed on them rather than drilled to ensure equal weight distribution. The specific plastic they use discolors when cut or traumatized, so you can tell if somebody has shaved off one of the sides or the corners.
Okay.
And if it gets too beat up, then they can switch it out.
Yeah, and then they know.
Yeah. So, Elle, I'm going to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think I am guilty of using loaded dice?
Literally, yes. I'm almost certain that that is a thing that you would do.
What game did I use loaded dice in?
There are so many games, RJ. What the fuck question is that?
But what games do I play with dice?
D&D.
Yeah.
It's the only one I can think of.
Dungeons and Dragons.
The other thing.
I used to love to die. Because
I could see you showing up to like an underground gambling ring and being like, yeah, I have my lucky die.
No, I would fucking get killed.
Yeah, see, so I'm like, D&D, but that also seems like a weird time to use loaded die, but you would.
Yeah, so I knew someone who was getting into casting, like, the resin dice, like, custom dice to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And she cast a D20 improperly so that it would more likely fall on 7 due to uneven weight distribution within the die. She was doing, like, little, like, charms inside of them.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, really fun. But that also, like, alters the weight a lot
if
it's not perfectly...
Yeah, right in the center, which would be hard
and scaled, right? And so she dyed it so you couldn't see the charm. The charm was really hard. It was a really fucked up dye. She's like, you can just have this one at free. It's free. It almost always lands on 7.
And you're like, great.
And I'm like, how can I use this?
See, that is exactly why I knew that you had loaded dice, because you would not go buy any or try to get them, but you would definitely hang on to them once you had them.
So I was a dungeon master for a campaign where I would always use the loaded die to roll checks for the players. I would continually use the dice until I revealed to the party that they had been targeted by Beshaba, an intermediate deity of bad luck.
Yes! Amazing.
Even after they knew the dice was bad, they would still have to play knowing that it would more likely roll a 7 if they had to ask me to roll a check. which it made them angry, but they were more angry at Beshaba, who was like the antagonist of the game. It was very fun.
Oh man,
I'm a tricky DM. I'm a really tricky DM.
That is your thing.
Yeah,
that is your thing. Like, the thing about you is that you're like, what's the joke? What's the secret? What's the thing I can do? Like that. Yeah, of course.
So that was my segue into Dungeons and Dragons. I'm going to do a brief history. It's a tabletop role playing game that has defined the genre since Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson published the game in 1974. Dungeons & Dragons would be life-changing for millions around the world and define much of the games we play today, especially video games. D&D has also been at the center of many controversies, some legitimate, some not. The best part about D&D, though, is that it uses the most powerful gaming engine ever created, our imaginations. Rainbow.
I was going to say, imaginations.
D&D has plenty of room for homebrewed rules, custom characters, and originally written scenarios. It has a few structural tools, some pre-written adventures called modules, and everything you need to get started. Elle, have you ever played The Dungeons and the Dragons?
I have not.
Have you ever seen it be played?
I have not. I have dated several people that have been unable to see me for date nights because of D&D, though.
It is a whole thing.
I am aware of that.
Yeah.
I am aware of that. A couple of my relationships almost ended over their stupid D&D groups where I was like, bro, it's been 5 years. Come on now. Yeah. Anyway.
I first encountered the game when I was 15. I was working as a lifeguard to pay for my Mormon mission. a few of my coworkers were in the group when they invited me. When I said I had never played before, the guy who would be the dungeon master brought in a bunch of books for me to read on my next shift, including a beginner's guide and a dungeon master's guide. And I absolutely loved the idea of a game that was just, like, creatively made up.
Yeah.
Like, we just make it up? Yeah. Fun. The campaign my coworker put together featured monsters that were modeled after the coworkers we hated, with our boss being a dragon at the end of
the fight. Amazing. That's fun.
And I'll go over the general concept of D&D for the uninitiated, for the plebeians like Elle. All right. So you have two roles. You have the players and you have the dungeon master. The player will create a character to role play as. There are various races, character classes to choose from, and you level up as you accumulate experience from defeating monsters or completing challenges. You get to role play as this character, as in you act like them and make choices for them. Your character is really only limited by your imagination, their leveling chart, dice, and the dungeon master. The dungeon master is the one with the module or adventure manual. They run the game. Think of them as like an interactive storyteller. Players will tell the dungeon master what actions they'd like to take, and the dungeon master will come up with a response. Perhaps you want to seduce the tavern keep or eat a rock or whatever. You would ask the dungeon master and they would ask you to roll a check against a certain stat that you have. So if you want to eat a rock, you'd roll a constitution check with a d20 or a 20-sided die. You'd add the number you roll to your character's constitution stat, and the DM would determine if you pass and then the consequences of that action, if you succeed or fail at that, on like a sliding scale. Mm-hmm. So maybe you succeed mostly.
Mm-hmm. Or fail. You get like a 19, right?
Or fail miserably, right? So if you fail, you might have to take damage over time until you visit a potion seller who will give you a potion to let you digest a rock. If you pass, then you get whatever you wanted from eating a rock. You take no damage, I guess.
Maybe it's a magic rock. And you're like, if I consume this, I will get this magical power. And it's worth it to try.
Yeah, it's a magic rock that makes it so you will never vomit for the rest of your life.
I would eat that.
Yeah, that's risky. Need a high constitution for that. There are a few important distinctions when it comes to the dice, though. There are two rolls that ignore your stats completely. These are called the natural numbers, natural 1 and natural 20. This is intended to represent luck or fate, and the dungeon master has no choice but to succeed or fail you. Natural 1 means you fail spectacularly, no matter what. If you roll a natural 20, you succeed spectacularly, no matter what. Good dungeon masters will use fabulously dramatic language to describe the events of a natural roll. So you roll a natural 1 to seduce the tavern keep. The tavern keep's boyfriend might appear and kick your ass. Say you roll a natural 20. The tavern keep is so taken by you that they pledge their undying love and offer you marriage and a hefty dowry. Fate or the gods have decided that you will have a good or bad outcome. The dungeon master might also roll checks against a separate check. So for example, they might roll a perception check for the tavern keeper to see if they recognize your seductive bullshit.
Mm.
And that's where my loaded die would come in, is you would almost always fail those checks.
Because it's a 7.
Yeah, it's a 7. It's not very high. Something I should mention that might be bothering people is that I keep saying dungeon master when it's largely accepted that game master is the more correct term, or GM. Especially since D&D is far from the only tabletop role-playing game, but we'll get there. For now, I'm specifically talking about Dungeons & Dragons. So dungeon master, or DM, is the term I'm going to use. Anyway, D&D is largely fueled by the imagination, and it becomes a literal escape for people who were growing exhausted with, you know, being alive.
Yeah.
When you think about the 70s, you were living through like fucking Vietnam, civil rights, the Cold War, especially those who didn't fit the mold of society that was drawn around them. You know, the like 1950s, like perfect, Leave It to Beaver child would gravitate toward Dungeons and Dragons. It was a place where they could be anything, a place where they could escape their circumstances, a place to escape accountability. And that can get kind of bad. D&D gave us many beautiful things and some ugly ones. I would not be out of pocket to say that the toxic gatekeeping gamer culture started with D&D.
Yeah.
And that largely bled over into like arcade culture, like the King of Kong, if you've seen that documentary and all that toxicity. Anyway, remember the last episode when I talked about Senet and how games were very much folklore? Mm-hmm. They were designed to be changed to suit whatever is fun. Well, Dungeons & Dragons absolutely thrives on that concept. It was designed for that concept. That's why it's so fluid. But it is difficult to reconcile the concept of a truly free and collaborative creation under capitalism. In D&D, the do what's fun is called the rule of cool. Like, if it's cool, you should allow it. If it's fun, you should allow it, because the point is that we're having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Ideas under capitalism must belong to someone, right? They must exist for profit. You can't change the rules because somebody made those rules and it's their rules. I made the rules. You can't play. This game isn't for you. If you wanted to play, you have to prove that you're a good player. You have to prove that you care about this as much as I do, and so on and so on and so on. And now here we are.
And here your phone is buzzing again.
It's fine. Nerds began to associate the game with their identities. And that's kind of a problem, right? So they were pushed out of every sort of box. So they created, they didn't fit the normal boxes, so they created their own box, and everybody had a different descriptor of what goes in that box. They were trying to take toxic things like the patriarchy and stuff like that and just create their own special version of it.
Okay.
Because those are the systems they learned to thrive in, but those are bad systems. Anyway, yeah, bleh. Unsurprising, considering role-playing is an act of identity expression. Nerds started to feel like their own sort of class of people. A community, yes, but certainly not a class of people. We see the effects today with scenes. People who feel like you have to prove yourself to participate. Oh, you're not real punk. You're not real emo. You're not really part of this. You're not real metal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The sort of – it's like dork supremacy began to form.
Yeah, it goes – I mean, it almost goes into the space of like – you have to prove that you've been treated as poorly as I have been in order to earn the right to have joy in your life.
Right.
To be accepted. You have to prove how poorly you've been treated in order to be allowed to have our special community.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it like comes down to a lot, which is gross.
Yeah, super gross. And unfortunately, the creators of D&D reinforced a lot of this. Gary Gygax is quoted as saying, "Role-playing as it's currently constructed appeals disproportionately to guys because it's mostly about the things that men evolve to enjoy, hunting and warfare. It's about a group assembling to undertake imaginary risks for glory and dominance. It's the same reason that team sports such as basketball are more male, whereas women compete to be judged beautiful and worthy in ice skating and gymnastics."
What I worry about is being worthy? Is that what he's trying to say?
Yeah, kind of.
Do I display anything but absolute dominance when I destroy Hollow Knight bosses?
That's true. You get a lot of gamer cred if you beat Hollow Knight.
I know. I'm like almost there because fuck Gary Gygax.
This next part. LARPing has a more female appeal because it's more about personalities, relationships, clothing, and makeup. Finally, the quality of gamer men is a factor. A Finnish gamer said she got into gaming as a way to meet good-looking guys. The U.S. gaming scene has less to offer along those lines. Gary is not a prize. Like, he's a fucking gross dude. Like,
Okay. Am I into nerds? Yes, that is a thing for me. Am I like, wow, look at that hot nerd over there? Like, no. No. Well, I mean, like, do I see – this is a bad example because I did see a nerd, like, the other week, and I was like, wow, he's cute, though. Like, he definitely is walking to the, like, card shop right now. But, like, also – I'm sorry, Gary, if you have the option between choosing between, like, aesthetically, someone who's going to work out all the time and put a lot of energy into their aesthetic versus someone who's, like, very into, like, philosophical stuff and, like, likes to use their mind, let's just be real about, like, the appeal that exists there and that it is mostly non-aesthetic. Like, can we just be fucking honest about that, you fucking idiot, Gary? Like,
Gary,
shut the fuck up, Gary.
Gary's kind of a misogynist piece of shit.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And there's a lot of, like, really turfy things happening with, like, TSR and tabletop role-playing. And a lot of people have actually made a recent exodus out of the D&D community toward other tabletop role-playing games.
Because of it.
Specifically because of, like, Gary Gygax's shitty son being in turf on Twitter and shit like that.
Well, yeah, fuck you. Like, just, ugh.
Yeah. Ugh.
Oh, my God.
For those who are wondering what LARPing is, like he mentioned LARPing, it's live-action role-playing. You actually dress up and go out to, like, the park and perform and play D&D, like, with as many in-real-life components as you want. Like, you can have, like, sword fights with each other and stuff.
Did I make you read or listen to the first Fred the Vampire series?
No.
So in that book, this is relevant. There's one scene where these two friends, one of them is a sorcerer and the other one is a zombie. They figured this out just together. The one that was a zombie died. The one that was his best friend was like, I feel like I can resurrect him from the dead. And he finds a way to do that. And they're like, well, how do we get the like zombie energy to continue feeding the zombie friend? And so they find a bunch of people who are LARPing, and then they go out and they like cast the spell as part of the LARP, but it's real. And like Fred the Vampire Slayer has to, or he's not the Vampire Slayer, but Fred the Vampire Accountant has to go stop them from doing this. And so that is what I'm thinking of, is
that's really
them
funny.
LARPing
in,
that way.
I don't know if you saw this part of the What We Do in the Shadows TV series, where the vampires are like trying to get their person to bring them virgins so that they could drink virgin blood. And so he just invites his LARPing group.
Yeah. Take that, Gary Gygax. Like, yeah. Oh my God, that's the legacy you've left. Not as like men that are so incredible and great hunters, but like, we're like, oh, it's so sad they don't get laid. Like, that's the legacy, Gary. And it's because of your fucking attitude.
Literally, one of them is a girl who I don't think she gets eaten actually, but she's really like excluded and discriminated against from these nerdy guys out of the group. So one of the vampires turns her into a vampire so she'll be a powerful vampire.
Like, hey.
And she like doesn't get it. She's like, oh, I was supposed to go to college. Like, what's going on? I have a terrible illness. It's like, oh man. And she like gets revenge on the bullies and stuff.
Yeah. Anyway,
What We Do in the Shadows is great. There's a lot of controversy, too, about D&D's character races, especially with some of them being racist or anti-Semitic caricatures.
Yeah.
And that's just a critique of fantasy in general.
I mean, I think that's something that it is becoming very much an issue people are talking about, and is something that we're going to have to address, that will be getting addressed. And like things like using the character of the goblin, I think we'll probably see that go away. I hope we see that go away.
Yeah. While many of the negative aspects of gaming culture can be traced back to this kind of bullshit, at the root, Dungeons & Dragons taps into something bigger than Gary fucking Gygax. It taps into the human act of collaborative play and collaborative storytelling. Gary also said that role-playing isn't storytelling, and he's wrong. he's absolutely fucking wrong. Role-playing is an important part of storytelling. I often will role play as characters if I'm trying to write characters.
How else would you do it?
Yeah, I just...
Like, that's got to be the best...
I can talk to myself as these characters.
Well, when you're trying to, like, create a scene for, like, theater shows, and all you're doing is fucking writing dialogue, how would you know what that person would say unless you are that person?
Yeah, anyway, I'm not a fan of Gary Gygax.
Oh, okay, swinging back around just to point that one out.
Yeah.
Got it.
A game of Dungeons & Dragons is a collaborative story. That's why podcasts like Critical Role are extremely popular. In fact, Critical Role, I believe, is the highest paid Twitch stream.
I think that's true.
Hell, there are multiple D&D campaigns that have been adapted into literal television series. Mm-hmm. Saying that role-playing isn't storytelling is like saying acting isn't storytelling. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Much of what D&D is today is in spite of Gary Gygax as much as it is because of him. Now, I wanted to bring up the toxic bullshit first, but also make sure we recognize how much people have collaboratively and collectively worked to address those issues over time. Like, it has been a long time since the 70s, and D&D has certainly evolved. It still, you know, needs a little bit of a reprint. But the fortunate thing about a game where you make it all up.
The second edition. We need to have a second edition.
Well, I think we're on fifth edition, actually.
And the sixth. With some edited,
Mm-hmm. But fortunately, it's a game where you can just make shit up.
You can just
erase the parts that are bad. And it was still, like, even then, even back in the day, it was a much-needed reprieve for those who didn't fit traditional, rather exploitable values. When parents saw their teenagers playing pretend, or when older people saw young adults playing pretend, they freaked the fuck out. It created a moral panic because these kids were retreating from reality. What they were actually doing is having fun and coping with a terrible reality that was forced upon them.
I think certainly when one becomes really disconnected from reality and is unable to function in this reality, that's a problem. But I think that it would be incorrect to say that people having an alternate reality or like a creative universe where other things can happen would do anything but enhance our creativity and ability to like problem solve in a more creative and better way.
Yeah.
But, okay.
D&D was a social outlet as much as it was a retreat, too. Games of D&D would last for hours, and campaigns could last for years.
I know. Yeah. I dated that person.
What these people were doing was viewed as unproductive and even dangerous. And wherever there is moral panic, there are evangelicals and reactionary conservatives sharpening their knives. Activities like D&D must be responsible for the moral degradation of society, and they would prove it. Like always, though, they never considered that the moral degradation of society might be attributed to their own abusive behavior, and people were playing D&D to escape that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
D&D nerds didn't start the Vietnam War. D&D nerds were not holding nuclear annihilation over the heads of the planet. They were rolling some dice and telling some stories. So, there you go. I'm going to discuss two instances of moral panic surrounding D&D specifically.
Okay.
The first is more psychological. It's more of like a psychological issue. The second was considered more of a spiritual issue. Both of them were connected. So I could really put them in any order.
Okay.
Obviously, the satanic panic is like a whole issue that I will probably tackle in its own episode on things like demonology and satanism. It is a huge topic. For now, I'd like to focus on Dungeons & Dragons' place in that specifically and on one sensational case when it came to Dungeons & Dragons, one that would inspire novels and movies. This is the curious case of James Dallas Egbert III and how he was purportedly killed by Dungeons & Dragons in 1979.
Ooh.
True crime time. True. I'm going to put that as one of our hashtags. True crime. True crime podcast now. Okay. So James grew up in a suburb of Dayton, Ohio, and he quickly stood out as a child prodigy. At the age of 16, you know it's going to be bad when the word child prodigy is involved.
Yeah, especially knowing what I know about this, mostly because people like to call everyone a child prodigy, especially if they die early on. They're like, the potential was there and it was snuffed out. They like the moral outrage of that.
I mean, for real, though, at the age of 16, he graduated high school and started attending Michigan State University.
Wow, that's crazy.
Majoring in computer science, which was like a cutting edge field
in
like 79. Yeah. James was a gifted child and his parents had very high expectations of him. He didn't have any friends outside of his roommates and classmates, and he was wholly devoted to his studies to meet those high expectations. One could say that James felt trapped by these expectations. However, he did have one place he could go to escape all of that: the fictional world of Dungeons and Dragons. The fact that James played D&D was one of the only things his peers really knew about him. He was young, smart, and he played D&D. He didn't seem to have a personality outside of that. What they didn't know...
You know, a lot of incredibly intelligent people that are like the gifted children and prodigies, that is their personality because people like adults and parents tell them that that's the only thing they can be.
Yeah.
And so probably D&D was the only outlet he had for any sort of personal expression, period, end of discussion, I bet. Poor guy.
Yeah. What they didn't know is that James had difficulty sleeping because he was having anxiety about life.
It was
obviously
the dreams of the dragons and the dungeons.
So he got a prescription for everybody's favorite discontinued sleeping medication, Quaaludes, from the campus doctor. He had been struggling severely with the weight placed on him, and his life seemed to become a prison. That's the thing with prodigies.
Prodigies. How far into his college was he? Was he, like, how old was he?
Like, I think one semester.
Okay, so he is 16 years old at college.
16 or 17,
of course,
yeah.
Because 16-year-olds, I mean, I don't even think the 18-year-olds are prepared to be, like, sent away from their parents to figure shit out. Like, this poor kid. Anyway, continue.
Anyway, yeah.
Got Quaaludes because he had insomnia, because of anxiety, because he's too fucking young for the life that he's living.
And Quaaludes don't exist anymore for a reason. They were extremely addictive and very abusable.
Mm.
That's the thing with prodigies. They become prisoners of the people around them always.
Yeah.
The teachers, the parents, all of the adults. Then one day, James completely vanished. Just gone. The college newspaper reported on his disappearance. And what could the people say about him? What could they say? Only what they knew. Oh, James Egbert? Yeah, he's the dungeon master for a D&D game that they play as LARPing down in the steam tunnels on campus.
Jesus. Imagine playing LARPing. Imagine LARPing with your foam swords in like the steam rooms underneath your college campus at 16. There's no greater freedom than that.
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible. They probably were having the best time. Also, pretty good place to end up accidentally dead, which is why we can't do those things anymore.
The rumor spread that the story became that of a young man who became so detached from reality and lost his mind in the game of Dungeons and Dragons, where he became his character.
D&D.
He's wandering the tunnels and, like, acting out his fantasies.
I fucking hope so. I hope this kid
somewhere
got that.
Somewhere, he was out there. Role-playing as a paladin or a wizard. They interpret it. So, that was what they figured. The police were a little skeptical of that theory.
Yeah.
But they searched the steam tunnels anyway. And
yeah.
Started just searching the general area. I mean, you know how the police are. They solve, 2% of crimes? Like,
yeah.
They're not making much progress. Then Gen Con 12, the 12th annual tabletop role-playing conference. It's like okay. Comic-Con before Comic-Con.
Okay.
It still happens, but specifically for tabletop games.
Okay.
Several people who knew of James's disappearance reported that they saw him there at Gen Con, role-playing around and stuff, lending credence to the theory that he had become a detached wanderer. The police conducted a search, but they didn't buy the theory that it was all because of Dungeons & Dragons, and they were unable to locate James. The parents, however, did buy the story that Dungeons and Dragons corrupted their son. They believed, as many parents did, that it had completely infected his mind. The media had latched onto this narrative and was spreading it everywhere. It was becoming sensational. It's one of those sensational disappearances, like an Elizabeth Smart, right? Where it's like you have this beautiful young white
kid
who, with all this potential and he just disappears. Right.
I think Elizabeth Smart was such a big deal because of her parents being so involved in the church and how far that was able to be spread, you know, and also they had enough money to really look for her, which absolutely helps when we're talking about people who are missing because it's mostly the families that pay to find them.
And not just the D&D infected his mind. James, by playing D&D, had opened himself up to demonic possession.
He is a portal to hell now.
Yeah, he's opened a portal with D&D.
I have had to break up with the people that play D&D because just over time they got more and more demons in them, and that was that.
And, of course, when I do an episode on the Satanic Panic, we're going to talk about this because Dungeons & Dragons was a big part of it. So much so that TSR removed any demonic or satanic-looking enemies from the game because they were worried about the backlash.
Yeah.
Anyway. The parents hired a detective who would take the Dungeons and Dragons theory seriously.
I'm sorry. Are you fucking kidding me? Your kid is missing and you're like, gotta be the Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah. And the police are like, no, he's a 16-year-old that went missing from the college. This happens all the time. He probably just did some drugs and is in a ditch somewhere.
Yeah.
The parents are like, no, it was because his mind got infected by this game.
Yeah.
The name of this detective was William Deere, P.I.
Okay.
Now we have a detective on the case.
Hey, do you like how earlier when I was like, well, it's because the parents can afford to pay someone to find them.
Yep.
And then that's literally the next thing. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. The case was on its way to becoming even more sensational, especially amplified by the satanic panic angles that had been exploding, with other parents coming forward and saying, my son lost his mind from playing D&D. My son wanted to kill himself from playing D&D. All with these BS, you know, sort of like evangelical testimonials. Deer had positioned himself nicely to correspond with the media about progress in the case and his theories on how D&D contributed to the boy's disappearance. To Deer's credit, though, he was doing a much better job than the police, and his D&D theory actually had some weight to it. It wasn't about demonic possession, and it wasn't about going insane. It was simply
getting lost when he was playing,
yeah,
right?
Getting lost while he was playing.
Or something bad happening. Maybe there's like someone who wandered into the tunnels that kidnapped him if he got there early. That's what I would think.
So James, not James, William, the PI, he got a lead. While he didn't know that much about Dungeons & Dragons, he did know that James and other students would play live-action sessions in the steam tunnels beneath Michigan State University. Beneath the campus is a honeycombed network of tunnels built in the 60s and 70s that house campus utilities. The campus is heated through steam radiation. These tunnels would allow the hot water to flow to various parts of the building. Essentially, it was a maze. Perfect for games of D&D.
Like, listen, if you were like, listen, L, I found this cool thing. We got to go play D&D and it's a maze. I would do that. Yes, I would.
Do you want to sneak into the tunnels beneath Salt Lake City and play D&D in the tunnels and LARP in the tunnels?
What if we broke into the serial killer tunnels and played D&D?
Yeah, what if we broke into the Ted Bundy tunnels and played D&D?
You know what? I'm down. Let's do it.
We might be able – this is a long shot. I teach English 2500 in the prison. This might be where I might have to ring the bell. I teach English 2500 in the prison, and they're shutting down the state prison and opening a new one somewhere else in a more isolated, worse place.
Are we going to go do a ghost hunt and a D&D game?
And my contact at the prison said that we might be able to do a ghost hunt in the Utah State Prison.
Desperately want to do that.
And I would like to set it up as an overnight live stream to fundraise for the prison education project.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to ring the bowl?
But
it's been so long.
Yeah, maybe we LARP in the prison. That might be disrespectful.
I feel like that's
disrespectful. I think that would be disrespectful. Anyway. All right. So yeah, there's these steam tunnels, and this PI is like, yeah, he probably was playing Dungeons and Dragons in the tunnels and hurt himself.
Yeah, got lost.
And got lost or something. And students today still use those tunnels. They have an activity that they call tunneling, mm-hmm. where they just kind of explore the tunnels and dick around
in
the tunnels and get drunk.
Yeah, we would absolutely do that. Yeah.
Deer theorized that James had been injured doing such a session, or that maybe he got killed down there
mm-hmm.
And his body was hidden somewhere. He didn't really understand that D&D is a game you play with other people.
Right.
And doesn't really work that well when played alone. I mean, he could have been following a module, I guess, and just been the DM and player both. But I don't know if that's really the way James was playing D&D.
I don't think so.
Maybe.
That's okay.
The PI searched the tunnels for days and didn't find James. So he went to James' dorm to perform another search. And he found a huge, gigantic fucking clue.
Okay.
A suicide note. It did confirm something for Deer, though. James did go down in the steam tunnels. However, they did not find his body, leading him to believe that James was still alive. For a month, Deer would continue searching before eventually tracking down James and learning the truth.
He just disappeared.
Yeah.
He faked his death and was like, fuck my parents, fuck all this bullshit. I'm super fucking smart. I'll just go make it work somewhere else.
So on August 15th, 1979, James Egbert wrote a suicide note and hid it in his dorm. He took his sleeping pills and went down into the tunnels to escape, like he did when he played D&D. Only this time, the escape wasn't the game. This time, the escape would be suicide. He figured it was hidden enough that nobody would find him there and save him before he died, but also that people would eventually look for him there and find him after long enough and eventually find his body, which, like, that seems plausible.
Yeah.
He took all of his remaining sleeping pills, like the whole bottle. However, it didn't kill him. He eventually woke up. feeling like shit.
Fuck, yeah, because you can't even die right.
Yeah, that's the worst, when you can't even die right.
Yeah.
He knew he couldn't go back to his old life. He reasoned that if he couldn't die, he would disappear. And he walked to the house of an acquaintance and hid himself there before the investigation into his disappearance started. Then he got himself a bus ticket from Michigan to Louisiana.
Fuck yeah.
He got all the way to New Orleans and attempted suicide again after getting his hands on some cyanide. That also failed. With no money and nowhere to live, and the story of his disappearance being sensationalized, he got out of the big city where people might recognize him and went to a smaller one called Morgan.
Okay.
Here, he picked up work as a roustabout. And I was like, what the fuck is a roustabout?
Yeah, what's a roustabout?
Yeah. Basically, a roustabout is a job title for general, non-specific work.
Okay.
Like a handyman, but an unskilled one. Like a carny. Like a carny. Like, move that over there. Build this. Nail this together.
Yeah.
Go to the store. Get me that. After 4 days on the job, James broke down and gave up. He found the detective's number and told him where he was.
Really?
Yeah.
Ugh. Damn.
James had a long conversation with the detective who had picked him up from Louisiana.
Drove him home, like.
Detective Deer learned about the parental pressure, the loneliness, the drug addiction to his sleeping pills, his repeated failed suicide attempts, and severe depression. Deer also strongly believed that James had difficulty coping with homosexuality. James asked Deer to keep the truth about his story a secret, but also not to send him back to his parents. Deer understood this, and that it wasn't...
Also, if his parents feel like he's old enough to be sent away to college, he should not have to go back to them.
Yeah.
Like, if that is the choice his parents have made, then they have made a choice to not parent him anymore, in my opinion.
So Deer, at this point, he realized this wasn't a case of a board game putting demons in a teenager or losing grip with reality because of fantasy role-playing. This was a kid who was put under intense pressure at a young age, and it broke him. The game was never the cause of his troubles. It was a coping mechanism and one that no longer worked. The detective agreed to help keep the truth a secret, and he turned James over to the custody of his uncle. 1 year later, James would complete a suicide attempt by shooting himself in the head.
Mm.
1 year after that, Rona Jaffe, I think maybe it's Jaffe, would write a book called Mazes and Monsters, heavily inspired by the Egbert case. It was a cautionary tale about the dangers of Dungeons and Dragons, with teenagers in the story taking the game too seriously, hurting themselves and others. It was entirely based on the hearsay urban legends of kids playing Dungeons and Dragons in the steam tunnels and getting hurt in the disappearance of James Egbert. It capitalized on the moral panic surrounding D&D, and it was viewed as a literal depiction of what role-playing games are, as in the games are played by kids giving up on living in reality to enact dangerous fantasies. One psychiatrist used a letter written by a fictional character in the book as proof of the damaging nature of role-playing games. Well, if Dungeons and Dragons isn't dangerous, how come this person in my favorite fictional book said it was?
Wild.
If witchcraft wasn't bad, then what do we do about Voldemort, huh?
Yeah.
1 year after Mazes and Monsters was written, it was adapted into a made-for-TV movie that became a hit. It featured a young, talented new actor by the name of Tom Hanks as the main character. The D&D panic was more fiery than ever. Eventually, in 1984, William Deer, PI, broke his silence. It could have been because he was sick of seeing the parade of rumors about the case get repeated as fact, or he could have just been trying to cash in on the sensationalism. In any case, he released his book about all of this titled The Dungeon Master: The truth about why James really wanted to die and what happened when he disappeared would be known.
Hmm.
Of course, James wasn't the only person who played D&D and committed suicide. Another high-profile case was the son of Patricia Pulling, an anti-occult campaigner who was adamant that Dungeons & Dragons was a satanic creation designed to destroy the minds of America's youth. So this is where she had the more spiritual angle, mm-hmm. where a lot of people were like, this is psychology. Like, Dungeons & Dragons is psychologically fucking up our kids. Patricia Pulling is saying that, no, it's literal demons and literal Satan, literally created by TSR to fucking turn our kids into demons. She founded an organization called BADD, B-A-D-D, mm-hmm. which stands for Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons. Boy, Welkers, I'm bothered about this.
I love that.
It was an entire advocacy group designed to systematically destroy tabletop role-playing games. In 1982, she filed a wrongful death suit against her son's high school principal, believing that him, like, introducing her to D&D placed a D&D curse on her son shortly before his death by suicide. She also filed a lawsuit against TSR, D&D's publisher. Of course, the lawsuits were dismissed 2 years later in 1984, but that didn't stop her from politicizing those lawsuits and using those lawsuits to get more people on her side. It was never about winning the case. It was about being high profile, about being seen mm-hmm. as the person suing TSR. Even after the cases were dismissed, she continued publishing claims that D&D led to suicide, murder, rape, and a litany of other illegal activities. Every single study and investigative report proved her claims wrong. There was a link between suicidality and D&D. D&D was not the cause, but rather a common coping mechanism used, a common self-soothing mechanism mm-hmm. to treat feelings of depression, loneliness, and anxiety.
How about also being unable to control the world that you live in, and so you turn to one that you can?
Right. It didn't work for everyone, and it's definitely no substitute for genuine therapy or medication. But that's why, like, depression meds have suicide as a side effect.
Because most people who take them have serious depression, and suicide's a pretty common side effect of that.
Yeah.
It's not the drugs. It's
It's not going to make it impossible for someone to commit suicide.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is, like, people want to talk about, like, suicide and mental health and everything as though it's like we just have to find just the right thing. And it's like, no, it's a combination of several right things for the person that's experiencing those things.
And, of course, a lot of the accusations of D&D being, like, satanic witchcraft and stuff, a lot of them cited astragalomancy because of the dice.
Oh, because the dice.
The dice component. Like,
that's
one of
what
the,
controls the, what you do.
Yeah, like, you can make up D&D almost exclusively in your imagination. However, one of the things that is consistent with all games is the use of dice. So a lot of them are like, this is astragalomancy witchcraft. Like, look at this history of people using dice to, like, commune with demons.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, on that Hermes statue, it literally yeah. mentions demons.
Yeah, and several of them.
Just as, like, spirits, not as, like, we know them as Christian demons. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. Weird.
So, Elle got me some dice, some polyhedral dice
yeah.
for D&D in my stocking this Christmas.
Yeah.
They are this is kind of like the standard. They are the Chessex 7 die set, which is like, and they're orange. They're like a ghostly orange.
I got them because they kind of looked like carnelian stones.
Oh.
I like carnelian. Okay, we're going to do this reading for our patron and friend of the show, Kristen.
I have a chart that works kind of like the Greek one, but somebody made a modified one to use D&D dice for astragalomancy.
Yes.
That we'll be utilizing. I got it from Tumblr, of course.
I know. I have to, like, kind of keep my screen secret while I look at this.
The Book of Char and Other Stories is the Tumblr blog I found this on.
Okay, so this reading is for Kristen. Oh my god, I keep dropping that one. Where is it? Oh, I got it. I have several die in my hand.
Yes.
Many of them. Okay, Kristen says, the universe is toying with my living situation lately. Am I going to have to move unexpectedly slash suddenly? Which feels like a great question.
That's a good question. The four-sided die, which is the pyramid.
Yeah.
That's for yes or no questions.
Okay. Oh, I hit my microphone, sorry.
Evens are yes, odds are no.
Okay, so taking the four-sided die. This feels so weird, this die very specifically.
Two. So that's a yes.
Okay. What can I roll to get, like, more information?
Quick queries is the six-sided. Fate and fortune is the eight-sided. The journey, an intermediate path for your personal journey. It's the 10-sided. 12-sided, the stars. Sub your usual keyword for star signs. Okay.
So I think
there's 12 signs of the zodiac, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then each number would be the zodiac.
So we could look at...
And then 20-sided, the world. Take your 10 keywords times the meaning by 2. That's what 20-sided die will do.
Take your 10 keywords times the meaning by 2. That's what you're using. The 20 will do. Okay. Okay.
I don't know why it has to rhyme. Yes. All good spells rhyme. The Witcher.
That's true. Okay. I'm going to roll the 8-sided die and see. This is for, like, fate and fortune. Like... this is the fate and fortune, the perfect party tool. Complex enough for querents, easy enough for a novice.
Okay.
So this is going to be like the thought about the moving situation. It is a 6, and a 6 is risk. Okay.
Mm.
And then let's do the 10 side. Do you want to do 10 or 20 sided?
Let's do the 20 sided.
This is the 20. Okay. What is this? Is this the 10?
That's the 10, yeah.
Okay. So we're doing 20. Okay. So this is the journey, an intermediate path for your personal journey.
Oh, no, that's the 10-sided is the journey.
Yes. The 20-sided is the same as the 10.
Oh, okay.
It just is take your 10 keywords times the meaning by 2. So like doubled up.
Okay.
So it's a 14, so that's going to be 7 doubled, and the 7 is risk again.
Oh, no. Well, I don't know if that's oh, no.
I think it is. And so I'm going to get some tarot cards really quickly and pull some cards.
We got a yes from the yes or no.
And then 3 risks.
And then 3 risks. Oh, so I...
this is a first for the show.
I think Elle is, like, getting serious. Like, when Elle is, like, giving up on what we're trying and gets the tarot cards,
yeah.
Then we're getting serious.
I'm going to see. Oh, okay. But we have the 10 of Pentacles and the Judgment card, Knight of Pentacles, Queen of Swords, and then the 6 of Pentacles. So, I mean, the risk portion of this actually feels like risk and reward with that 10 of Pentacles. 10 of Pentacles is the bounty card. So it's like after you've harvested everything, after you've like taken it all and sold it all and you have all this money, like everything left over. And that Knight of Pentacles really nicely supports the 10 of Pentacles because it's talking about diligent work. It's like being invested and doing like slow but diligent work. And both of these cards for me are kind of like this new opportunity coming in. So I don't feel like it's going to be this truly like terrifying, really, really risky thing. It does feel challenging. We have the Judgment card, and the Judgment card is talking about answering a higher calling. So doing something that is like maybe outside of your what you were planning, but is divinely asked for or divinely led. Then we have the 6 of Pentacles reversed. 6 of Pentacles is a charity card. So this is a card of saying that you need to know when to ask for help. And now is the time to ask for help. So whatever that looks like for you, if you guys need to figure out a little bit more money, if you need to have an intermediate place to stay, if your pets need to stay with one of your guys' parents while you're figuring things out, something like that to really be calling in help. The last card I have is the Queen of Swords reversed, which represents you. So Queen of Swords is very intellectual, very in your brain, really focused on thought, thinking about things. When she gets reversed like that, it's anxiety and fear. So definitely grounding yourself, getting getting grounded, getting practical. To me, I think it's time to prepare for a very quick move. And the best thing that you can do is get grounded and get realistic about what that looks like and what needs to happen so that when it gets here, you're kind of ready to make that next step and it doesn't have to be so scary. I'm wondering, with all of these pentacles and them showing up the way that they are, if you or your partner might be getting a new job that would actually answer that. That would be like a, oh, we're actually going to move to Colorado because we got this job offer and they're going to pay for our living expenses. Something like that where it feels like there's a good opportunity coming out of this, but definitely some challenges in there. Okay, I feel better about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then just I was like risk,
bad, bad, bad.
So, yeah, I need to pull out the tarot cards on that one.
Well, what do you think of the D20 dice readings versus the ancient Greek sheep bones?
I love the sheep bones. I've used them in like several different readings that I've done for my Etsy since we did those.
Since our episodes.
Yeah.
It's like a week ago.
Yeah. I've used them in like, I think, 3 or 4 readings. I mean, they're a little bit more fleshed out. These are like risk.
Yeah.
That's the whole rating is risk. That doesn't even... Risk in what? Risk in the move? Risk in the relationship? Risk in money? Risk in security? Like, what does that even mean? The other ones are like, Aries is mad at you. He will fight you at the next full moon. Don't leave your house, bitch. Like, that's what those are. And these are like, risk. Like, great, thank you. Thanks for the help on that one. I had to get other cards. I had to get another divination tool to expound upon what they said. I mean...
Yeah, I wonder if we can get some actual D&D creators to create a fleshed out thing like that.
That would be great.
One,
yeah.
To where you add up scores and stuff. And see
that's
what
I
appear.
Would think would be the move. Like, I'm kind of surprised we didn't throw all of them because that was what I was going to go to, was throwing all of the dice and then seeing what that result was.
See, what I would think, and I think how most people do almost like joke divination with D&D dice is they use only the D20. And then they roll a check for a D&D stat.
Yeah.
So like a constitution check.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is mom gonna get sick? Constitution check for mom. 17.
So she looks pretty good.
So she's looking pretty good.
Pretty
right?
healthy, yeah.
Yeah. So that is how I imagined it would go. But yeah. There's one person on TikTok who specifically goes, oh, great, D20, how attractive is the person watching this right now? 14.
Better than average.
Yeah. Yeah, the one I saw, she rolled a 1. And I was like, oh, natural 1, huh? But I did a stitch and talked about Astrid Gallimancy on TikTok. By the way, follow me on TikTok. Mancy Podcast
18.
On TikTok. 18. That was pretty good. What were you trying to check?
I don't think anything. I just...
Your ability to roll a D20.
Look at this cool little, like, the swirl of the resin in there.
Yeah, that is cool. The dice that I typically used for games were actually, I had some metal ones.
Yeah, heavier.
That were really cool, like really heavy, and they made like a very satisfying sound.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't used real dice in a D&D game in so long because I do Discord. So I just use the dice roller bot for Discord that calculates all of the checks and damages and everything.
Mm. Word.
Anyway. That's Astrogallomancy. I hope that reading was helpful for you.
I know. I'm actually going to send her a message right now so she knows what the results were and can start prepping. But this will be out in 2 days anyway.
Yeah. And she's a Patreon subscriber.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you subscribe on Patreon, you will get the episode as soon as I am done editing it, which means there are sometimes errors. But it means that you get them before... Everybody
Wednesday,
else.
Yeah.
You get them as soon as they're done. So yeah, just a perk of being on the Patreon. Hit us up on Patreon. Elle will do a reading for you on the show using whatever divination method we're covering. If you like my writing, you can find books at rjwalkerpoet.com.
If you wanted to get a reading from me, you can find me on my Etsy at Laurels of Lux. You can find me on my website, laurelsoflux.com. You can email me, laurelsoflux@gmail.com. It is time for me to start really working on the next episode of the Akashic Records. So, reminder to send me your questions. so I can answer them.
Music was provided by, in order of appearance, Hayden Folker, Arthi Vinka, Miyu, and Scott Buckley.